When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The movie is a meditation on obsession.
Yes.
And on the virus of obsession, and how this sociopath's virus, his obsessive compulsive behaviors lead to the destruction, not only of the people that he murders, but also to the people who try to chase him down, because that same obsession gets in their head. And whether it's Gray Smith or whether it's, you know, Toski or whether it's Downey's character, any of them are destroyed by this thing. And you see other people save themselves from the obsession.
Yes.
Anthony, you know, like
Anthony Edwards.
He gets out. He just gets out. I got to get out. I can't do this. I can't survive this. And that moment in the script where, and in the movie where, Gray Smith packs it all up, throws it into a box, and then a little while later, it all comes out again.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the end of anything that is remotely, that could be remotely considered a normal existence.
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle. 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac. Adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by screenwriter James Vanderbilt, the film stars an incredible ensemble cast led by Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards, Elias Koteas. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Our introduction today, the Zodiac himself, Mr. John Carroll Lynch. Before we dive into the theme of the week and the show proper, I'd love to remind you to jump on and rate and review the show wherever you're listening. It's a huge help for those fellow lovers of our brand of obsessive cinematic deep dives. Also want to let you know that the links to our Patreon with exclusive Rum and Rant weekly podcasts and special uncut Zodiac Sessions interviews, as well as links to our merchandise with artwork by the incredible Brianna Ashby and Amy Reid, are in the show description or at oneheatminute.com. Now, today, joining me to see if this subject warrants further investigation are, in my opinion, the world's greatest living film critic, the senior film critic at the New York Times, multiple-time Pulitzer Prize nominee, Manolo Dargis.
Thank you very much. You know, I just come back so I can hear you praise me. You know?
If that's the only reason, I'll keep praising you, so you keep coming back. And returning, the screenwriter of Zodiac, Mr. James Vanderbilt, filmmaker and screenwriter of Rounders, The Girlfriend Experience, Ocean's 13, and co-creator and showrunner of Billions, Mr. Brian Koppelman. And of course, our introduction was not the only time we're going to hear from the award-winning actor of stage and screen, a man whose roles include films like Fargo, The Trial of Chicago 7, Gothica, Shutter Island, The Invitation, The Founder, but also Zodiac. That's Mr. John Carroll Lynch. This is the 14th episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Cancer Part 2. This is perhaps the most iconic and important scene of the entire film. Mark Ruffalo's Inspector Dave Toski, Anthony Edwards' Inspector Bill Armstrong, and Elias Koteas' Sergeant Jack Mullinax head up to Union Oil in Vallejo in Rodeo, California. Their task? To interview a suspect who suspiciously laid out a plan for the Zodiac's reign of terror exactly almost 11 months before it came to pass, and whose ambidextrous writing ability, at the very least, warrants a face-to-face. Every episode, we've used a film title to encapsulate our theme. This episode puts these dedicated detectives in front of their most fascinating suspect yet. So the theme of the week, sharing its name from James Foley's 1986 fatalistic family crime drama, is At Close Range. Let's get to the scene. We left off after Paul Schultz's Sandy Panzarella, whose 70s hair is just the bridge between the Beatles and Martin Riggs' lethal weapon mullet, stares intently at John Hemphill's Don Chaney as they both recall the mounting occurrences of Lee's dubious behaviour. The final straw, Lee being able to write with both hands,
and Schultz's terrific pronunciation of ambidextrous a perfect choice.
You can talk to him in here. Coke machine's busted, by the way. I'll go get him for you.
So how do you guys want to do this?
A white Chevron reads, one day later, Rodeo, California, August 4, 1971. The Bayside Union Oil Factory is pluming steam and smoke from a crowd of smokestacks bunched along the inlet. The faded pastels of silos decorate the hillside as the camera tracks along the foreground freeway route. In the opposite direction, screen right to left, Toski, Armstrong, and Mullinex are escorted into a break room. Pastel green on the outer walls and black chicken wire windows give the feeling that it's a cage. Perhaps, suitably, there's a sign that says, be careful, safety first. The talent bursting from Ruffalo, Codius, and Armstrong as they briefly strategize here feels like watching like Federer stroll onto a court in his prime. There's an unshakable aptitude, this implicit confidence, that they're more than up to the task of this scene, and then from the outset, their characters are up to this encounter. There's no false bluster, just a nomination that Armstrong spoke to the eyewitnesses and therefore he should lead, and they'll back him up.
So how do you guys want to do this?
Well, Bill talked to the informant, two leads we follow.
Okay by me.
We cut to a vertical track down seeing John Carroll Lynch for the first time as Lee, accompanied by the repetitive thumping thrum of machinery. And we check our pulse. Every time I watch this scene, I can feel my pulse quicken. There's a fantastic shot of the three police officers watching Lee walk their route into the lunchroom. And the composure and cool of every man just cracks. It's almost as if to say, holy shit. This is the guy. It's here you have to take a moment to marvel at the costume choices. Toski, a deliberate, form-fitting suit with a thick, eye-catching tie. Armstrong, an off-the-rack suit from a looser fit and the shapelessness of the jacket and pants. And yet city detectives have a look that they're required to maintain. And then we have the down-to-earth Mullinex, whose tweed jacket looks like it hangs on the back of his office chair for occasions such as this. The mustard color of his shirt is the color of the day. And Mullinex essentially blends with the paint job of the brick walls and the shiny plastic chairs. As this trio stands alongside yellow bricks, it's hard to not think of the Wizard of Oz. A tin man, a lion, and a scarecrow preparing for a visitor that may as well be from another world. Here's John Carroll Lynch on getting the role and what it was like preparing for the role of Arthur Lee Allen.
The key to approaching any character is getting the job. You know, that's the primary thing you've got to do is get the job. And so it starts in the audition process. Lorraine, who is David's casting director, called me in for the part and I had the scenes to read. And I don't think I had the full script for the show, but I think very soon after the first reading, I did have that. I went into their offices, into David's offices, and read for the part, and then got another callback with David himself and Lorraine, and we chatted about the character then, and he was, you won't be surprised to hear, methodically prepared for the movie. In a holistic, fully holistic and obsessive way. And when I read the full script, which I don't think was, as I said, very soon after my audition. So it starts with that and the conversation that I had with David about the character and also the materials that I was given. Unlike most things you get to do, he had a historian on staff. And so he showed me the timeline of the various spots that the murders took place, the various attacks that were ascribed to the Zodiac, and where Arthur Lee Allen was at any given time. And he was in geographic distance for all of them. And he was a likely candidate for the, you know, for a suspect. And his behavior in the interview, and also his behavior in other interviews that I saw, was so chillingly presentational as human. It was like watching somebody who was acting the part of a human being.
Yes.
And I could never fully get to the place that Arthur Lee Allen had in those moments in some of the later interviews, particularly when they were closing in on potentially indicting him, and they had gotten a search warrant and found pipe bombs in his basement. You see him kind of getting ready to kind of weep. I mean, he's just so put upon. It's just, he's a victim, such a victim of the system. And the detective is letting him run for a while. And he goes, yeah, but Arthur, what was with the pipe bombs that we found? And you watch this victim thing just completely drain away in a matter of a second. And all of it's gone. No residual sense of the emotion being there at all. And that is a turn in terms of human behavior that's, you know, chillingly difficult to perform. I all of the people who act for a living, they in some form or another are connecting to their emotional life and presenting it. And so you work on those skills. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And I've never seen anything like it in terms of it costing nothing, not a shred of energy. And he was as cold as ice the very next minute, without anger, nothing.
You as an actor are so dedicated, and you've got to get yourself into scenarios where you can create the conditions for you to do this easily. And then just like any level of performance, that must be like... you come home, you know, I think some people go to work and they do a presentation or they're a teacher or whatever. Mm-hmm. They feel like they're on, in a sense that you're mm-hmm. on as an actor performing their role. And then they come home and they're exhausted. But to think of him just like, and I want to give full credit to you in that wonderful interrogation scene, you have a moment that's like what you're describing. When Toski goes, after you were fired from a school for abusing children and you...
I tried desperately to get to quality of Allen's work in that interrogation. I could never fully reach the level of emotional connection that he seemed to have, followed by no emotional connection, like you unplugged a light.
Yes.
While I tried, I mean, I did my best to create that response. It was in the text and everything. You know, I did the best I could. I'm grateful. I don't have that level of disconnection. I'm grateful as a person that I can't fully disengage from emotional life and to be as almost inhuman in that moment. That's the only moment that he appeared inhuman.
Yes.
in the interviews. And along with those moments, there were fully engaged moments of what seemed to be perfectly human behavior.
Yes.
And then when we were getting ready to do the piece, when I had gotten the part, and I was talking to David, and I don't know if it was that interview or another one, he said, "I need you to play this as if he's not guilty."
Yes.
I cocked my head at that, and then I started to work on it. I came to a place where I could believe that he wasn't guilty of these murders, and it's a grotesque defense. Arthur Lee Allen was arrested for a child molestation, and he was in prison for that. And society has certain norms that we've all been taught since childhood that is the right thing to do, you know.
Yes.
And we're very, I mean, these things are very strongly inlaid in us, and they're good and bad, you know, gender roles, what people are consider to be appropriate, sexual relationships, sex outside marriage, and it goes on and on and on. And one of the strongest ones, rightly so, one of the strongest injunctions is you don't have sex with children.
Yeah.
And to rub through to have a predilection that rubs through that particular social taboo to the point where you act on it is so difficult to work your way through. It's difficult to imagine you'd have room for another. That you'd go, oh yeah, you know, I wasn't, it turns out I really didn't want to have sex with children. What I wanted to do was kill people.
Yes.
You know, I don't see that as a normal path. And certainly child molesters as a group don't end up murdering people. One of the reasons why is because the thing they're most interested in, sadly, is control.
Yeah.
You know, control over the intimacy they're allowing, and they choose the most vulnerable among us to maintain a sense of complete control. And Zodiac's behavior in those murder scenes, there was a lot of risk taken on by yes. by him, and also a really excellent skill set, I hate to say. He possessed certain skills. That was a dead eye shot with a pistol, and he was doing it
at night
with a flashlight taped to the pistol.
Yeah.
And he shot somebody from 25 feet away with a pistol. That's
and now all the lies that movies have told us. Oh yeah, all the lies that movies have told us is that that's very easy. But I think
absolutely not.
It is absolutely not.
No, and I've participated in scenes where I have, you know, like wantonly just raised a pistol and shot somebody. I've pretended to kill a lot of people, I remember a scene I did in Carnival where, you know, he just comes out of the bathroom firing of, you know, yes. a 1925 45 caliber revolver, a service pistol, from, you know, 30 feet away and hits somebody right in the chest. And you're like, well, no, you're not doing that on the move.
No.
But the Zodiac hit his targets while moving at night with a pistol from a distance, and did it with a light source taped to his gun. That's somebody who's practiced a lot
with
that.
Mr. Allen. I'm Inspector Bill Armstrong, this is Inspector Dave Toski, and Sergeant Jack Mullinax. We're investigating the Zodiac murders in San Francisco and Vallejo. Please, sit down. The informant notified us that you made certain statements 11 months prior to the first Zodiac murder. If they're true, they're quite incriminating. Do you recall having any such conversations?
No.
Have you ever read or heard anything about the Zodiac?
When it was first in the paper, but I didn't follow it after those first reports.
Why not?
Too morbid. I told all this to the other officer.
Which other officer?
From Vallejo.
Do you remember his name?
No, but it was right after the murder at the lake.
And what did you tell this officer?
You don't ride with the devil in Zodiac. That rare American movie that doesn't turn murder into kicks. With cool intelligence, David Fincher's masterly opus tracks the years-long effort by several detectives and newspapermen, including Robert Graysmith, who wrote the book on which the movie is based, to find the killer, the self-anointed Zodiac, who committed a string of murders in Northern California starting in the late 60s and perhaps continuing into the early 70s. Zodiac is about an investigation, and is itself an investigation. As is always the case with Mr. Fincher's movies, it is also about extreme human behavior and an example of the same. Extremes possess the murderer and those who chase him. Men whose desire to solve killings burns away large swathes of their words. "I need to know," Graysmith, Jake Gyllenhaal, tells his wife, whom he eventually drives away with his compulsive pursuit. That need is ultimately frustrated. The Zodiac killer remains uncaught and officially unnamed, which gives the movie a strange pathos.
In the end, there is no confession of guilt or triumphantly condemned prisoner, no trial or justice. All that remains is the search and the filmmaking. That near definitive examination of Zodiac and the interrogation scene, called Building Suspense Along the Trail of an Invisible Man, is written by none other than my next guest, Manola Dargis. We have a broad and roaming conversation that expands upon the themes of her iconic piece to talk about how Zodiac is in microcosm this scene.
Oddly, I wanted to start with, I think everyone who writes about movies and thinks about movies, they have these different touchstones for them. You know, they read something by someone, really affected how they looked, you know, how they approached their own work. And for me, it was very casual. I was reading New York Magazine when John Leonard was a critic. He was mainly a literary critic, but he also was a longtime television critic. And he was writing about a show I really liked, the American police show called Homicide. And he said, and I wish I had pulled it up, and I'm sorry I didn't. He said something to the effect of that he'd learned more about men and human behavior in just these interrogation scenes in Homicide than he had in, whatever he was saying. I don't think he was actually saying he'd learned more than like reading philosophy, but how much he had learned just from this very simple setup of a few people in one room. And I was very, very struck by that at the time.
Yes.
And I don't think I really understood how brilliant an observation that is. I am very much, as a movie person, I am obviously very interested in visuals. And I think, if anything, I'm drawn to people who have a kind of very strong visual style, visual signatures. And that's often, the filmmakers who I kind of revere will have these very strong visual signature. I think that Fincher, whose work I've greatly liked since the very beginning, since his much despised Aliens movie, he was someone who obviously has a very, he's telling stories through visuals. And yet, here we are in this movie. This movie is, comes very close to 3 hours, and it's, in the director's cut, it speaks a little closer. It's a lot of scenes of people talking. It's a lot of scenes of men in various kinds of rooms talking. And then we get to this room, and it just feels like everything is there, and that it is one of the most tense scenes I could imagine. And how Fincher is able to create tension through just a series of kind of the relay of looks, the dialogue is really great, and Fincher does not always have really great scripts, unfortunately. This is a really, really good script, and it's kind of minimalist here. This is really simply three detectives talking to someone who may or may not be who they think they is. And you're on edge. And I was rewatching it. I rewatched it a couple times before we started talking. It's very, if you break it down just in terms of what actually happens, it's super, super simple, right?
Yes.
The detectives go into the room. they stand there waiting. Then Alan is brought into the room by another man.
The briefest moment is, who is going to talk? Like, it's very cordial. Who is going to do the speaking? Well, okay. Well, Armstrong will do the speaking, and we'll both lead. We'll both support. Okay.
Right. But in basic terms, it's basically men enter a room.
Yes.
They sit down in a room. They talk, and then they leave.
Yes.
And your heart is just thudding, because if we replay it again, it's of course how Fincher tells this story.
Yes.
The visuals are very, very good. I mean, it was funny. I remember when I reviewed the movie, I was so struck by the color yellow throughout,
yes.
And how yellow kind of functions. I think, what does yellow mean, as a warning sign? It's not red, but it's not green. It's yellow.
This is the first time I've ever done this on a podcast, Manola, but I really, I've in the time of COVID, I've tried to set my studio podcasting because there's so many podcasts to try and make it as good as I possibly can. And I made a choice on some chairs for guests when I am ever allowed to have some such guests in my house again to talk face to face rather than a Zoom call. And you're never going to believe that when I was watching the scene again and again, I discovered that I have the very same chairs that that I literally, this movie has been a brain worm and has like taken my decor taste. I have two of those chairs in my office right now. And I'm like, oh my God, I literally have the chairs from the interrogation scene in my office, which is kind of, you know, for people to be interrogated on, I suppose, if they come in and do that. Yeah, so
wild yellow chairs that they sit in. The yellow is, there's also a really important yellow in the newsroom that we have characters. A yellow that of course also makes me think of all the president's men. I'm just closing the circle here. So.
Closing the circle.
The sound design is extremely important in this scene. I mean, I think it always is with Fincher, you know, but I think that I often think about his visuals, and he was working with the Viper digital camera. It was a very big deal at the time. It was very cutting edge. But that someone could actually make just a scene of, you know, four men in a room turn into your, you know, you feel like your heart is throbbing much like the sound of the machinery that basically introduces our suspect, you know, which is very intense, is really quite something. And I think that to be able to do that is just on another level. Not everyone can do it. I mean, Scorsese is obviously someone who can, but, you know, just to have, I mean, Scorsese does a lot with the camera, and of course, like, one of the most virtuosic scenes in contemporary cinema is the long walk into, you know, Goodfellow. You know, we're very used to, like, that's the, you know, that we think of that maybe even as like become the signature. But I actually often think it's just how different, how you shoot people around a dinner table or an interrogation room that you can make come alive through camera angle, through editing, through those choices, and of course your actors is really important. And I think one of the things about Fincher also, because he's such a kind of visual fetishist, you know, in a way, and we fetishize his fetishism, that he's very, very good with the actors. And they're all very, very good here.
No, but it was right after the murder at the lake.
And what did you tell this officer?
I told him that I'd gone to Salt Point that weekend to skin dive, that I was alone, but I met a couple there. I have their names at home if you want.
That would be great, Arthur.
Lee.
What?
Lee. Nobody calls me Arthur. Also, that day when I came home, my neighbor saw me. It was around 4, but I forgot to tell the other officer that.
Neighbor's name?
Bill White. He died a week or so afterwards, heart attack, so I didn't think to call to follow up.
Here's John Carroll Lynch taking us to what it was like to perform the scene on the day with Anthony Edwards, Mark Ruffalo, and Elias Koteas.
There were no first aid jitters, which was nice about the filming of it. We drove down to Industry, I believe was the city. We were in the city of Industry in an old cookie factory, I think, or something like that. And the other actor, by the way, Marty Lodge, who played my supervisor who brought us in, Marty and I knew each other from Washington, D.C. He has been in his life and may be there now. I don't know where he is now, but he was kind of a foundational member of the D.C. theater community. So I knew him from back in the day when I was in school. So it was nice that he was there. So we started the scene, and Hugh knew from his reputation that Fincher was going to be exacting and that there were going to be, you know, many, many takes. So you had a preparation for that in terms of reputation.
Yeah.
And I don't think I had met any of those guys before. I had worked on the same lot with Anthony Edwards while he was on ER. I was on Drew Carey, but I don't think I'd met him. I met other people on that show, but not him. It was the first day that I met Mark. I've worked with him subsequently a couple times since.
Yeah.
So, and Elias is there are very few people who are as underrated as Elias Koteas. I would say that the thing about Elias Koteas is you have to work hard to remember his name, because when you watch him work, he is whoever he says he is during the time. Yeah. And then you have to go, who was that fucking guy? What is that guy's name? I mean, I fucking love that guy. What is his fucking name? And then you have to go back and look for it. You know, John Ortiz is like that. Oh, I saw John Ortiz in a half a dozen things. And I was like, God, I love that guy. God, what is that fucking guy's name?
And you're like, is it Jose Hierro?
Fuck is that guy's name? And then I finally was like, I went to the IMDb page and I just said it to myself six times in a row. That's John Ortiz. 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 And then the next time I saw him, I went, that's John Ortiz. I mean, he has the gift of creating that reality for you right in front of your eyes, and you don't think of anything else. And Elias is like that.
Yes.
So there we were, and we sat down, we read it. The lighting was universal, so it was a lighting package that didn't need to be changed. Only the camera positions were gonna need to be changed. They could be changed to any place in the room. The framing was quite precise, as all of his framing is.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
And you knew you'd have time because you were going to get a bunch of takes. So you knew you were in a marathon, not a sprint. Mm. And then the day proceeded and the work proceeded. And we went from fairly wide shots, as you do, into more coverage shots. And then we got into the close-ups, and we didn't finish our day. So we came back the next day and finished in the half day. And we finished the scene, and I'll go back through it, but we finished the scene, and the four of us stood up, and there was a quiet moment. We shook each other's hands and thanked each other for the days. And then all of us were like, I mean, this was really fun, right? I mean, we're all in agreement that this was like a super fun day, super fun set of days, right? Everybody was like, yeah, this was just amazing. Like everybody, every little note that was given, every little thought that was given to one actor fluttered its way through the three other actors. It was like sitting with a jazz combo and like, you know, I don't play music, but I watch jazz combos, and you see like the bass player hear what the piano player is doing, and you feel the change in the music. And that was how it was. And to be with, to play with Elias Kataeus, and I don't know, hundreds of times to say, you know, the blood from that was in my trunk was the chickens I'd killed, whatever that line was. And every single time, Elias had never heard it before.
Yeah.
Every single time he went, wait, what? And you just were like, every time it had a little slightly different nuance, but every single time it was, oh, this is a totally, now we're into something. Up till now, there was nothing. This guy was creepy, but you know, who isn't? But now it's like, now where do we go? And every time you said it, every time you did it a little differently, you watched it riffle through all of us. And every time David said something that changed the energy, which he gives fantastic acting notes, really, really substantive, on the mark, very particular acting notes. Every time anybody got one, you just saw it ripple through. Mm. I don't remember him ever taking anybody away to talk to them individually. So the scene was an ensemble scene. And it was treated as an ensemble scene. And even in people's individual coverages, there was never a secret between the director that was withheld from the other actors.
Yes.
What difference does that make? Well, there was an opportunity for all of us to play the same moment together. Now, that doesn't always help, and it doesn't always work. But with those four actors, the three of us, and with Marty and in the limited time he was able to play with us, everybody changed. It was just, it was like being on the widest dance floor possible. You know, there you could go anywhere and everybody would follow.
He died a week or so afterwards, heart attack, so I didn't think to call to follow up. The knives I had in my car with the blood on them, that blood came from a chicken that I killed for dinner.
What?
I had knives in my car that weekend. Maybe Bill saw them and called the other officer on me.
Well, we'll be checking in on that. Let me ask you something else. Were you ever in Southern California at any time in 1966?
Is this about the Riverside killing?
Yes.
Well, I guess I was there around that time. I used to go down there a lot. I like the auto races.
In the coverage, there's a shot that I can't get over, and it's part of your line delivery where you move your leg, you cross your legs, and Fincher tracks Elias Koteas' face watching you cross your legs. I just can't get over it, John. I just look at it. I look at your physicality and your movement and the tension of the scene, him looking at you, and that same shock registers in his confusion. Like, this guy's getting comfortable in front of me. And I just think there's these little...
I watched that came from the... I mean, it was in the script, and also David was insistent on the gesture.
Yes,
but it was also in the interrogation videotape that I had. And when he did it, there was as there was through my body too. Arthur presented in his life and presents. I certainly tried to help that along. He presents as very, you know, in the modern parlance, as very cis. Very masculine. When he crossed his legs, there was this kind of shudder of feminine energy that went through his body, very shocking, like you recognize there was all this kind of presentation going on in the interrogation. And so when the script called for it and when David wanted it, and I really felt like that was not only that he was getting comfortable, but that it was, he's not who we think he is absolutely not who he's presenting himself to be.
No.
Yet the presentation is full and complete. So, I mean, it should be like a sudden crack. Like what's a great example of it? Like there are times where, you get to see actors acting and then they'll be in the middle of something and you'll see it in outtakes where something will happen and they'll just crack through to some other energy.
Yes.
And that was what it was like. Only what opened up was discomforting to see, uncomfortable to watch. And that's what I tried to embody. And that was not just that he was getting more relaxed.
Yeah.
that he suddenly realized that they weren't as close as he thought they might be.
Yes.
But also that the person that he is, you see the slim, you see where the costume doesn't quite fit.
Yeah. And I think you put it so perfectly of like, this is a person performing what humanity is.
Yes. And yes, he's performing the role of Arthur Lee Allen.
Yes. Wow.
In a very naturalistic aesthetic.
He's definitely a post-Brando naturalist. Nothing theatrical about it.
There's no operatic. He's not in the Johnny Depp school of acting. He's definitely definitely following the, you know, he's a Lee Strasberg guy, no doubt.
Foreman says that you're ambidextrous.
No, that's untrue.
You can't write with both hands.
My teachers tried to make me when I was a kid, but I couldn't. I'm left-handed.
He also said that you made statements about killing school children.
That is That is horrible. That's a horrible thing to say.
So you aren't angry about being fired from Valley Springs for touching your students?
John Carroll Lynch responding to the detectives who are asking him questions. But there is also this little thing that starts happening where their gazes start zigzagging, the looks that they start giving each other. And Ruffalo's looks are really, really important. They're very punctuating, you know? So Yes. There comes a point where John Carroll Lynch just like brings up these, the bloody knives that he had, you know? And it's horrible to, I mean, and we laugh because, but it's very.
There's no other response because it's so out of left field. And those bloody knives that were in my car, it's like, what? Like they all literally go, exactly. What?
It's uneasy moments. And I think Fincher is very good here where you're really upset. You're really nervous. There's a lot of anxiety. And it's almost like this weird kind of impolite joke, you know? And you're just like, am I supposed to laugh or what? And you see them all react, but it's really Ruffalo's look where it's almost, he kind of is looking around like, wait, what was that? And I think that he's kind of like mirroring our own in a way. I think that he is, at least in this scene, it's that like, wait, what in the hell was that? Kind of moment. He's not doing the kind of, he's not pressing the investigation along. He's not kind of pushing it along at that point. He's reacting very much like us. And I think that there's something really, you know, kind of, filmmakers like to do these self-reflexive moments where, you know, the audience, you know, where you kind of see this kind of cinematic thing happening on screen. And there is very much where, you know, the detectives are Lynch's audience at that moment, you know, where they are waiting for him to give a show and he responds by giving them quite the show. And it's a really beautiful. I mean, Lynch has a beautiful voice and he does some very beautiful kind of silky sinister vocalizations here that are really amazing.
And there's a great moment also, you talk about the correspondences of the call and responses between the questions. There's a moment that Ilias Curtis, which this is one thing that got me this time watching it with you in preparation for this minute, is there's a moment where John Carroll Lynch puts his legs together like he's getting comfortable. Like, so for, and he raises his leg and he crosses his legs and you literally chart this beautiful camera movement that comes almost from the floor up to Ilias Kodis' face, which is puzzled. Like, hold on. Oh, I'm sorry. You're getting comfortable for this chat. Like, it's this really strange moment, but it's that that almost starts this sort of like domino effect of correspondences leading up to our great double take moment of like, oh, and forget the bloody knives in my car. But it like starts with he's getting relaxed. He's putting on a show and the camera, then the setup, it's almost like after all this stillness and this very, you know, very sort of programmed understanding, like you said, like you're keeping it very much in the character and the behavior of these people. You don't want to put too much showiness on it. There's a couple of really then delicate, like, oh, here's a close-up of each of these guys. Something is dawning on them as this guy is talking. It's a beautiful tension. And then it just all starts happening and you're like, whoa, this thing is accelerating. Well,
there's a few things. One, there's a shot where he crosses his leg.
Yes.
And he does it, but he's crossing his leg not in the way where you cross your ankle over your knee. He crosses his legs like, you know, it's often considered more of a feminine, though I don't believe, you know, I'm just saying in gender terms.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And there's this weird shot where his boot, you know, he has a boot, a short work boot, is kind of looming in the scene. And we get Ilias Kostas looking at it, you know, where there's this weird where he's looking at. And that's really important because when John Carroll Lynch is first coming down the hallway and there's that incredible mechanical, it's like some sort of weird mechanical heart, right? It's the pulse.
Yes.
Boom, and it's boom, like boom. The monster is coming. John Carroll Lynch also gives the character a kind of slight hitch, almost a kind of limp.
Yes.
And Fincher, you see him and the camera's kind of low. And then it has a slight pan down to his feet.
Yes.
It's very weird and disturbing. And, you know, when we think about the Zodiac as this question mark, as this kind of fugitive figure that we have not quite seen, but seen disguised. It's a kind of great moment of, I felt like this is the monster coming to us.
Yes.
So I think there's that kind of the I think those two shots of his feet are definitely in play in
yes.
terms of the character. But I think it's interesting the way that Fincher uses these close-ups, because he does have these direct close-ups that aren't over-the-shoulder shots, you know, they have this kind of very, they create this kind of stress, you know, where each man, each of the detectives, and including actually Lynch, that's right, are isolated in the frame, you know, and it's a very...
I think that word stress is so perfect, because the first one that happens on Elias Koteas's face is stressful, because it's like a realization, but you're like right in his face and you go, oh, and then bang on Edwards and then on Ruffalo. And you sort of acclimatized to the rhythm, the beating heart is there, this guy's lumber up the hallway is there, all this like rhythmic stuff. But that one of the flash, you realize that you're occupying their real intimate stress, each of them, and they're all wearing it differently. Like Elias Koteas's character is a bit more naked with it, yes. But Edwards is so much more composed. And then Toski does this lean. Like there's just something that Ruffalo gets about Toski's, I don't know whether it's like that confidence that happens, and it happens in Homicide in spades, but it's like that confidence of an interrogator, like, oh, this is what's happening. This is who we have.
Yes. So there's this kind of the way that Fincher uses these close-ups are, there's the stress of the characters are undergoing, but it's also just, I feel like there's a kind of nakedness that, you know, so much of this is about people and the limits of knowledge, you know, that's what the movie is about. And you have in an interrogation, you're trying to find out something from this person. And so, you know, usually in a show like Homicide or Law and Order, or, you know, we can go down the line, there is a kind of assumption that most of the time, 90% of the time, the detectives will find out, you know, what, in fact, there's this Netflix show that I've watched, which is set in different countries where it's basically all takes place in an interrogation room, right? Criminal. But there is this kind of assumption that as we keep asking our questions, you know, that we will be rewarded with the answers. And one of the things about this movie is it says no. But, you know, there's a kind of like each face is expecting, hoping, wanting, you know, more knowledge, more answers, something. And the way that Lynch plays it, again, with this kind of silky, sinister quality, is very unsettling, because he's, you know, the scene is too short for him to be broken, but you also get the sense that he probably never could be broken. You know, that there is this, I mean, he's big, he looms over the other men even when he's sitting, which is a really kind of interesting thing. And then there's that great question where this great moment where he says to them, you know, he says, I'm not the Zodiac. And then he says, and even if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
It's maybe my favorite line in the whole movie, like in a movie that doesn't necessarily have lines of dialogue that ring out, but like, I'm certainly not the Zodiac killer, but I wouldn't tell you if I was. And it's like, that's not what you say if you're innocent. I mean, just in like, it just, maybe we're just programmed to kind of know that now, but.
Well, I think it's also, it's interesting, because I think watching it the first time, I was just very uncomfortable and also very preoccupied with just watching it. But I think that when you watch the whole movie and you know what happens, it also takes on this kind of eeriness, because, you know, bad things happen, and sometimes bad people are not punished for those bad things, you know, and that no matter how much you can keep going for almost 3 hours of movie time,
yeah.
you know, that you will have this kind of unknowable evil, you know, that you have these men who are just constantly going at it and trying to figure it out, and they're turning around for years. I mean, it's just they just seem to lose it, you know, spiraling into alcoholism. I mean, it's just, and there's something, and it's interesting because I did not know that about how Fincher directed Lynch to play that, because what's interesting about how Lynch delivers it is that it sounds very, very phony initially. Yes. It's got this very, he's giving it this quality of like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Like this, it's got this kind of very, I think, intentional artificiality.
Yes.
You know, this artificial quality that you can hear, this kind of almost, I can't say brittle because that really goes against how his voice sounds, but you're just, it feels like he's, you know, lying to them. So for the fact that he actually was told to deliver it as if he's innocent makes the character seem even more of a sociopath.
Yeah, he's so much phony. And I think the brittleness is to the point is when he's putting up that artifice, he's less like the John Carroll Lynch that we know. As soon as he settles into that voice, and his voice is so undeniable. And once he starts talking in that, and the proper register of the vocal cords come back, other than that sort of I think your artificiality is right, because some people it's like, oh, have you got any plans this weekend? And it's someone you maybe don't want to hang out with. So you go, oh, this weekend, let me think. I'm not sure. And your voice hits that high register. Yeah. I feel like that is the beginning of the conversation. And once they put upon him and he's sort of overwhelmed by facts, it then starts to, it's almost like it starts to filter, the filter that he had is starts to disappear. And then again, that realization moment of like, everything now is mounted to a point that even what I'm hearing them ask me makes me sound like I'm guilty, even if I believe that I'm not. And in this moment, he's trying to register that he's not. And it's an unforgettable scene. It's like the scene in the movie that almost like makes your knees buckle, because you go and later on in the film, you get the Charles Fleischer scene, and there's all these other like kind of these other threads and tendrils and possibilities that also make you really uncomfortable. And you can see and you register the madness that these guys feel later in their lives, because it's this unanswerable, it's forever the unanswerable.
You know, it's funny though. I think it's interesting about, again, how the scene is structured, because, you know, I think Fincher is a very kind of no fat director. I don't believe that there's anything, I think that everything that he's showing you is supposed to be there. And so then, you know, the scene again opens with these detectives being walked in, and it's a long shot. So you can see their full bodies, and they're being led by someone who works at the factory, and they walk in, and there is that sign, of course, the danger sign that's right there, which is funny. There's a little warning sign, you know, it's like danger, danger. And there's a kind of weird grill or something there too, with the window, some sort of, it's a weird, strange, you know, it's almost could be like prison bars or whatever. And so that's the beginning. And then the scene though, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the scene end with him leaving, with Lynch's character walking out, and we're looking still at the detectives through the glass window.
Through the bars. It's like a lattice of metal.
And
we're looking at him through the lattice, he's looking back at the detectives through the lattice. And he's lumbering along. And Tosk is the only one standing, hands on hips, watching him, trying to maintain eye contact as he walks out. And Carol Lynch is breaking eye contact. He's sort of glancing back in and lumbering along.
But I just think, you know, again, this is not to sound too ridiculous, but I think it's important that we had seen the detectives walking in, and the scene actually ends with him walking out. You know, there's a certain kind of symbolism even to like who gets to... Who starts the scene is our detective, but who ends that scene? And who is on the outside, and they're kind of stuck in the room, and they will remain in that kind of symbolic interrogation room, right, for the rest of the movie, because they will never fully be able to crack this case. So that to me is very, there's a really neat symmetry that Fincher sets up, visual symmetry, that I think is also, when someone is working visually to make the meaning of the narrative and deepen it, is just, you know, this is why we do podcasts like this. So.
Well, I guess I was there around that time. I used to go down there a lot. I like the auto races.
Foreman says that you're ambidextrous.
No, that's untrue.
You can't write with both hands.
My teachers tried to make me when I was a kid, but I couldn't. I'm left-handed.
He also said that you made statements about killing school children.
That is horrible. That's a horrible thing to say.
So you aren't angry about being fired from Valley Springs for touching your students?
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
That's a nice watch.
Thank you.
May I see it? May I see it? Where'd you get it?
It's a Christmas gift from my mother 2 years ago.
That's very sweet. So tell me something, Arthur. You don't remember anyone you might have had a conversation with regarding the Zodiac?
Maybe Ted Kidder of Phil Tucker at Vallejo Recreation. But I couldn't be positive. I used to work there. The most dangerous game.
What?
The most dangerous game. That's why you're here, isn't it? It was my favorite book in high school. It's about this man who waits for people to get shipwrecked on his island. Because he was tired of hunting animals, he hunted the people for the challenge.
And man is the most dangerous animal of all?
That's the whole point of the story. Great book. Or at least that's what I told Phil. May I go?
And for the final word on this episode, here's Brian Koppelman talking about the knives in the car revelation. And finally, James Vanderbilt, that the truth of this interview is actually stranger than fiction.
I mean, when Lee talks about the knives in the car, that
I find myself laughing just in the middle of the day. And I'm thinking about that line. I'm thinking about, like, there was the blood from a chicken. It's like, what?
And he knows what he's doing. You know, it's a masterful scene. And of course, I'm sure you've done this. I mean, I've looked up Lee so many times because the performance is so incredibly great, right? Yeah. I mean, he was just, I got to work with him on Billions, and he is just such an incredible pro. And John Carroll Lynch, and what he does as Lee, the way he's calculating how good these cops are. Because at first he does come in and puts on a bashful air. And he has that one moment where he says, one thing I certainly wouldn't tell you, but then it resets again, right? That could have ended the scene.
Yeah.
If I was the Zodiac, I certainly wouldn't tell you. And then the scene goes on for like 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
And he swings back and forth between wanting to get let off the hook and wanting them to know he's the Zodiac. And because whether the world thinks it's Lee, I mean, I think Fincher in the movies decided that it's Lee.
Well, John Carroll Lynch, especially, I think, just does such an amazing job with it because he plays it. So, he's so angry. Like the whole scene behind it, he's so furious that these people have shown up where he works and that he's probably going to lose his job. You know what I mean? There's a sort of moment, and he's so convinced he's smarter than all of them. And he conveys all of that you know, in a scene that has to, I mean, the thing about that scene that's so crazy to me is that it's, you know, it's verbatim from the police reports, you know, and we had to sort of put it together in the right way. But what he's saying, what he actually said to the police was so incredible. It's the worst things you could, I mean, it's like one humdinger after another. And so for John to come in and play it so well and play it believably that a human being would actually say these things to the police, and he's able to be very scary and very pathetic at the same time, which I don't know how you achieve, but he does it.
Great book. Or at least that's what I told Phil. May I go?
Sure. Thanks for your time.
I'm willing to help in any way possible. I look forward to the day when police officers are no longer referred to as pigs.
Thanks. We'll be in touch.
So does anyone think this suspect warrants further investigation?
That concludes episode 14 of Zodiac Chronicle, Cancer, Part 2. Be sure to subscribe to the show so you're the first to know about all the upcoming episodes. And if you can't get enough, Unplugged Zodiac Sessions will be available exclusively on the 1-8-Minute Patreon, linked in our show notes. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, and presented by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by The Duff, Chris Duffy of Los Espinas. Our companion, I Am Not Avery, Zodiac Chronicle stickers and pins were designed by the incredibly talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. Buy one, why don't you? Huge thanks to Manola Dargis, obviously John Carroll Lynch, James Vanderbilt once again, and Mr. Brian Koppelman. But until next time.
Goodbye.